Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture titled A Skyscraper for Mussolini, Mario Pallanti and Urban Planning for Rome in the 1920s. Speaking will be Dietrich Neumann, Professor of History of Art and Architecture at Brown University. Tonight's lecture is presented by the Graduate Student Art History Association in the Department of Art History at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by graduate student Hannah Blunt.
I have the great honor of introducing Professor Dietrich Neumann. Professor Neumann received his PhD in architectural history from the Technical University in Munich. He comes to us this evening from Brown University, where he has been a member of the History of Art and Architecture faculty for more than 20 years. During that tenure, he has been the recipient of no fewer than 5 teaching awards, including the Royce Family Professorship for Excellence in Teaching. Since 2007, he has also been a visiting professor in the School of Architecture at Yale. Professor Neumann's research focuses on late 19th and early 20th century architecture. He has published a very imposing list of books and essays on topics from the history of building materials to German skyscrapers of the 1920s, from Richard Neutra's Windshield House to Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's Barcelona Pavilion, on film set design, architectural illumination, and even a children's story, Joe and the Skyscraper. Professor Neumann has also curated a number of exhibitions, including Film Architecture, Unbuilt Providence, and Luminous Buildings, Architecture of the Night. He is presently working on an exhibition opening in August at Yale about the modern architectural lighting designer Richard Kelly, as well as a major new biography on Mies van der Rohe. Professor Neumann is current president of the Society of Architectural Historians and a recipient of that society's Philip Johnson Award, among other distinguished honors and grants. Tonight, Professor Neumann will discuss a little-known project from 1924 for the world's tallest skyscraper, designed for Rome under Mussolini. I hope everyone will join me in welcoming Professor Dietrich Neumann.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction, and I wanted to thank Sarah and Hannah for inviting me and for organizing this whole thing. They were really very nice and followed up on everything very professionally, and happy to be here, and also, of course, were thrilled to see Professor Miller and Professor Morgan and Professor Kleiner, and I'm honored that you could. What I wanted to do is basically share something with you that I've been fascinated with for quite a long time. I think I discovered this design and began researching it almost, I think, just the years before I came to Brown University. And I haven't published it yet, but I think I'm getting closer and closer to publishing it. And I always sort of, when I have time or when I'm in Italy or in some specified library, I sort of add a little more, a little piece to the puzzle. And it is, I think, in the end, maybe just a story, an incident, perhaps a footnote in 20th century architecture history, but I think it has interesting implications, perhaps, and as you'll see, it's to a certain degree still a work in progress, but one of those, I think, magnifying glasses that allow us a little glimpse into a particular culture and situation. On September 24th, 1924, the New York Times carried a rather astonishing headline on its cover, as you can see: Mussolini to build highest skyscraper to rise 88 floors, 1,100 feet above Rome. And the article continued, Premier Mussolini today decided to erect in Rome the largest and tallest skyscraper in the world. It was to have 4,500 rooms, it points out, 100 large halls, theater and a gymnasium for the training of Olympic athletes. And the article explained to its readers the tallest office tower at the time was the Woolworth Building in New York, about 792 feet high, and the tallest man-made building was, of course, the Eiffel Tower. But the article also mentions that the style was somewhat comparable to that of the Woolworth Building and that the tower was meant to celebrate the fascist revolution. The architect was a man called Mario Pallanti, who was Italian but had a very successful practice in Buenos Aires and had lived there for the last 15 years. He was born in 1885 and studied at the Accademia di Brera in Milan, roughly at the same time as Antonio Sant'Elia, and I'll quickly show you something later, who was his classmate and I think his early designs somewhat respond to a similar mentality, perhaps, and carry a similar monumentality. And Pallanti's career takes off much more promising than Sant'Elia's, who is, of course, much better known today. He graduates in 1909 and wins a competition for an Italian exhibition pavilion at the World's Fair in Buenos Aires and leaves for Argentina from Italy. And then over the next decade, he establishes a well-functioning practice in Buenos Aires, where he builds about 80 residential and commercial buildings and continues to develop visionary designs. And you see here this sort of strangely Baroque interior and some monument to an unknown hero, it seems. And here are some buildings he did in Buenos Aires, a movie theater on the left and a hotel, somewhere in these years just leading up to the First World War. And in 1916, he's already so famous that he has an exhibition at the Palace of Fine Arts, the Palazzo delle Belle Arti in Buenos Aires. And then he has to return to Italy briefly to fight in the First World War, where Sant'Elia sadly perished, as we all know, already in 1914. And then he returns to Argentina to his practice and has what I think are his greatest triumphs immediately after the war, two skyscrapers, both the tallest in their respective countries, in the centers of Montevideo and in Uruguay and Buenos Aires, Argentina. And you see here the Edificio Barolo in Buenos Aires, a big, strange-looking office building. And he obviously got inspired a little bit by South American Baroque, I think, and translated that into cast concrete. And then immediately afterwards, he builds the Palazzo Salvo in Montevideo, with 30 stories, even taller, but with certain similarities in the design approach, as you can see here. And this one on the right was, at that point in 1923, the tallest tower in reinforced concrete in the world. So it's also an engineering achievement of a tall order and very, very, sort of unique in its approach. I think it took the title of the tallest tower in concrete from a building in Cincinnati, the Ingalls building, which was half the size. And so a source of great pride. Actually, both buildings have a sort of lighthouse installation at the top. The idea was that they would sort of look at each other and send beams of light across the Rio de la Plata and establish this sort of modernist statement there in South America. Quite beautiful. He had, of course, the idea, as I think one can see from these wonderful photographs, that he would establish some South American skyscraper style, really an answer to the American skyscraper, a Latin rascacielo, as he calls it, and the reference point, South American or Curigoresque Baroque. The sort of symbolism of these towers is quite significant and important to him, and he is really at the height of his success at that moment in 1922-23, wins a great prize at the South American Exposition of Fine Arts in Buenos Aires, and he's quite famous in his country. And then he hears in 1922-23 that the fascists have taken over power in Italy, Mussolini's march on Rome, and he is fascinated, one has to say, unfortunately. He's fascinated with fascism, and he immediately signs up as a corresponding member of the fascist party in Italy and plans to return to Italy. He also has some money. He establishes a stipend for young architecture students in Rome in the name of Mussolini, and he sends a book to Mussolini with his that came out when he did this exhibition with his earliest designs. And Mussolini writes back to him a little postcard and acknowledges the book and calls Pallanti an architect who knows the Latin and the Roman courage of construction, signed Mussolini in 1923. Thus inspired and encouraged, Pallanti begins to work on what he sees as the crowning project of his career, a gigantic Roman skyscraper for the fascist revolution. With this design in his luggage, he returns to Italy and meets with Mussolini, who is apparently quite enthusiastic. And as a sign of his approval, he agrees that Pallanti can hold an exhibition. He can organize a show of this building, of his design, in the library of the Palazzo Chigi, which is the seat of the foreign ministry, in Rome in September 1924. So Pallanti puts up these plans, And the building was meant to stand, this is the footprint, obviously, right next to the Palazzo Chigi and stretch all the way to the river, to the Tiber River. It's an enormous footprint, and you'll see a map in a moment. And so there are two large theaters, chambers for Senate and Parliament, cavernous interiors with many functions, meeting rooms, a hotel, a gigantic steam bath for the senators in this building. And here are a few more views of this design. And indeed, it's much taller than the Woolworth Building or any other structure. And here is the interior view to the Hall of Parliament. On the right is the steam bath for the senators, also quite cavernous. Mussolini shows up at the opening, comes to the exhibition, and says he discusses the project, according to Palanti, and gives it a name and exclaims, "Per la Mole Littoria, allala." Mole Littoria is refers to the Roman official, of course, Littoria, who was carrying the symbolic fasces in front of the politicians in processions, and Mussolini adopted that term, would later name the first of his new towns, Littoria, and the allala that he exclaimed at the end was a short version of the fascist battle cry, "Ia, ia, ia, allala," which the writer Gabriele D'Annunzio had composed for Mussolini and his fascist black shirt troops. Of course, at that moment, Palanti is convinced that he has a very good chance of building this here. A few more, another drawing of the interior for this gigantic skyscraper. And here is Mussolini's little dedication that he writes down at the opening in the guest visitor's book. And so the question, of course, that arises is, of course, that, how Palanti tried, in fact, to convince the Duce that this was the project to pursue. His brother was a painter who had stayed in Italy, Giuseppe Palanti, and he was well-connected. He was actually at that moment in 1924 painting a portrait of Pabst Pius, as you can see here. On the left, there's the painter, and on the right, and somebody else is doing a sculpture of the Pope and Pope Pius, and on the right is actually a portrait that Palanti's brother did of the Duce. And so he felt he was really well-connected and had a good chance, in fact, of getting this building built. But as you can imagine, there was a certain response in the press to this idea of building an enormous skyscraper in the center of Rome. And there was an enormous, immense echo to this plan that had appeared in the New York Times on the front page. And so the New York Times was by no means the only one. Here is a cutout from the Washington Post in October 1924, which, out of some strange reason, quotes the Providence Journal, as you can see here at the top. And I was delighted, of course, to find that. And, he talks about this and says something like that it is a rather... Pantheon, the Forum, the Pantheon, the Colosseum did not achieve their stateliness by the perpendicular. So it warns, of course, against perpendicular buildings. But fascism obviously has its own ideas in architecture as in politics. And Signor Mussolini is the sort of man who is inclined to make his own decisions. So clearly it is somewhat negative, but still hesitant in its critique. There are others a little more vocal. Here's, for instance, the Los Angeles Times. Skyscrapers chafing Rome. Mussolini's plan for 80 stories causes stir. Many fear city's beauty is to be threatened, and the structure would outstrip America's largest. Here's a German magazine, Deutsche Bauzeitung, which is an architecture magazine, responds to it and writes. In fact, it's published in Berlin. Very long essay, as you can see here, with an image in the center, Ein Wolkenkratzerentwurf für Rom, and goes in great detail into complaining about the destruction that this would render to the heart of Rome, and which already had been caused, the magazine points out, by the entire lack of scale in the Vittorio Emanuele Monument in downtown Rome. Now, this skyscraper, the magazine argued, was a monster, a Tower of Babel, a deadly sin against which the world's Christianity should revolt, it points out. Mussolini also received a number of letters in the mail, and one, for instance, comes from a man called Lee T. Smith, who was president of the National Association of Building Owners and Managers in New York, who offered assistance to Mussolini. He wrote in November 1924, "The announcement of your decision to construct in Rome the world's largest office building is received in America with great interest, not only by the public at large, but in particular by the building managers of the nation." And he was a building manager and wanted to get into the business. So he offered that his organization of the National Organization of Building Owners and Managers in New York would take care of the building management, and he enclosed a little booklet for the Duce. I found all of this in the archive in Rome and EUR, and it's all very nicely preserved there. And the question I want to, of course, address is, first of all, where was it located, so that we understand a little bit what the fuss was about. So we are here in the center of Rome, and we have to imagine the tower somewhere there between the Palazzo Chigi and the river. So here in this sector, obviously, and this is what it would have looked like in a photo montage that my wonderful student Henry Harding put together last year as a little exercise. And so I think it is obviously understandable that there was a certain amount of resistance against it and a huge discussion all over Europe against this project. And I'm still looking for more Italian sources. Of course, we are under fascism, so to speak out against a project that Mussolini was apparently sponsoring was already a rather dangerous undertaking. So I haven't found too many outspoken voices there, but I will hopefully spend a little more time in Rome in the summer and look through more newspapers. But, of course, it's worth thinking just for a second about the scene in Italy and how much they had actually engaged with skyscraper design. How novel was that for the city of Rome, of course. And if one looks back, the first Italian skyscraper apparently was this design for Milan in 1909 by Achille Manfredini, not built. And then, of course, you all recognize Antonio Santelia in 1914. Here again, his design for the competition of the Milan railroad station and other designs for his future city or the new city that he was working on, inspired and in conjunction with the futurists, and other futurists like Virgilio Marchi and Mario Chiatone, for instance, would after the war in the early 20s contribute ideas such as these just around the time. But this is all, of course, northern Italy, and very few skyscrapers had ever been designed for Rome. In Europe, one can think of Corbusier's much-published Plan Voisin in 1922 and then redesigned in 25 for the Heart of Paris, or Mies van der Rohe's famous glass skyscraper that was also widely published and known in Italy in 1922 and then published internationally more towards 23. So these were things that were in the air and that were known. And, of course, in 1922 was also the international competition for the Chicago Tribune Tower. John Meade Howells and Raymond Hood won it, as you all know, but it was an international competition with participation from around the world, and many Italians took part, many Germans. Here's Walter Gropius, of course, with his design, and Adolf Loos, who, with his sense of humor, had realized that the word column can mean both a newspaper column and an architectural element, so he threw it together and designed this. But apparently Loos deliberately sent it in rather late. He was living in Nizza at the time, so the entry came late, and all the German entries, including the famous one by Walter Gropius, were in some box that mysteriously was held up in customs and never made it in time for the decision. But so the man who won is an interesting person, Raymond Hood, who was actually from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, studied at Brown, and then went to MIT and then to the École des Beaux-Arts. Interesting figure. But, of course, what interests us are the Italian contributions there. And here's Marcello Piacentini, who rose to great prominence under Mussolini. He designed this sort of setback, slightly historicist skyscraper with a big clock and a balcony in front. And there's Crescentino Caselli, for instance, with a rather strange tower with Gothic elements and columns, chimney-like columns at the top. There is Saverio Diugardi, who didn't get too much usable floor space out of the whole thing, I guess, for the imagine this is in Chicago. And then there's this one who, obviously wants a lot of advertising up at the top of Vittorio Pino. this strange armoire or, you know, chest of drawers by Guido Guerriero and Arturo Tricomi, with another setback skyscraper, Giuseppe Boni, who got an honorable mention. So we see there is obviously, this is a new topic. There's no real skill there in designing skyscrapers for Chicago amongst all of those. And probably Piacentini was already quite prominent, had probably expected to be the one to get the honorable mention. Every country had one honorable mention. That was just sort of standard in this competition, and instead Giuseppe Boni got it. But, of course, Piacentini is an interesting figure because in the end he was Mussolini's most prominent architect, and he had actually just at the time when Palanti is designing his tower for Mussolini, 22-23, he had published an essay on the occasion, of course, of the Chicago Tribune in the journal Architettura e Arte Decorative about skyscrapers in Tema di Grattacieli. And he points out, he shows, as you can see here, wonderful drawings by Filarete, who already had designed very tall towers in the Renaissance. And, of course, he joyfully points out that the Italians really invented the skyscraper in the first place. And but then he makes very clear that skyscrapers would not fit into Italian cities. In fact, that he says very nice and poetically, he says, the sky into which the Cathedral of Milan or the Dome of Michelangelo reach cannot be shared with a skyscraper. And then at the end of the article, he points out, niente grattacieli dunque in Italia. Therefore, no skyscrapers in Italy. So he writes that in 1923, just the year before Palanti arrives with his design and his luggage, of course. And so the atmosphere is already, in a way, already somewhat hesitant. But there were, of course, others. Here's the wonderful Piero Portaluppi, who had in 1922 designed a skyscraper for New York City, where it fit well with his brilliant idea of placing it over an intersection so that the traffic could flow and otherwise unused real estate could be made useful. The air rights idea is sort of fairly new at that point, and he designed skyscrapers such as these and a few more drawings. It's quite wonderful, Edilizia, and then he has designed for a fictive American firm that you saw here, SKNE, all fantasy drawings, of course, in this joyful Italian approach, and then designed some sort of sketches for American cities that he called Lucky Town and Helly Town. There are others, Renzo Picasso, who designed a skyscraper in Genoa in 1923 for a Tower of Peace, as you can see here on the left, and then Limonghelli, in 1927, studies for an Italian version of a skyscraper. So there's very little that is convincing, and I think many, of course, share Piacentini's opinion that Italian cities are not really in need of skyscrapers, and probably it would create an enormous contrast. So back to Palanti, of course, who might not have known about these critical contributions because he had gone back to Argentina after this exhibition and returned to his office in Buenos Aires, but he had not given up on the design of the tower and on his strong desire to build it. And so he began to sort of design alternatives, and I want to come back to those in a moment. But first I wanted to talk a little bit more about the international reaction. I'd mentioned to you all those letters and newspaper articles that appeared in response to this monstrous design. But I also wanted to mention this man here, Cass Gilbert. He's the architect of the Woolworth Building in New York, and he apparently was a great admirer of Mussolini. And I found a letter with the help, actually, I should mention, of my dear friend and colleague, Gail Fenske, who just wrote a book on the Woolworth Building. And he writes a letter to Mussolini, which has survived in the archive. And it's quite interesting. Here it is. It's not been published. And he writes, and I quote, on October 16th, 1924, as the architect of the Woolworth Building, which, with the exception of the Eiffel Tower in Paris, is the highest building in the world, and having built many other high structures, I can perhaps claim to have a little knowledge of them. And then he hastens to say, I have followed, to Mussolini, I have followed your career with the greatest admiration, and I believe in you and what you do. No one has arisen in our time, and especially since the war, whom I so greatly admire. I do not say this to flatter you, but in all sincerity, so that you may realize that it is in no spirit of criticism that I write this letter. And then he politely gets to the subject at hand and tells Mussolini that he is concerned that the tower would impair Rome's beauty and distinction. And he suggests that Mussolini might, and I quote, reconsider the whole subject and instead ask his architect to design some other type of structure which will not be excessively high but in harmony with the beauty of Rome. And he makes a very concrete proposal. And I quote, for example, a majestic colonnade or the completion of the approach to St. Peter's. For example, so that the vista may be obtained from the riverbank at the Ponte Sant'Angelo straight up to the facade of the cathedral, a great needed improvement which would really embellish Rome, he writes. Now, this was an interesting idea, the idea of having a street from Castello Sant'Angelo to St. Peter's. And this is what it looked like at that moment, of course. The area between St. Peter's and the river with the Castello Sant'Angelo was a sequence of small squares and houses, the so-called Borgo Nuovo. And the idea of breaking through there, and you see it here in the photo and then down there, of course, in the map, this Borgo Nuovo. The idea of breaking through there and, in fact, eliminating this part or building some sort of street was by no means new. In fact, Bernini himself had already thought of a connection to the river. Would have been an appropriate piece of Baroque town planning. The only important difference would have been that Bernini would have included his famous third arm of the colonnade, so to shield St. Peter's from view and create a sudden liberating transition onto the open space of the piazza. That would have been over here in this open space, the third arm that he contemplated, and the wonderful drawings by him. But of course, you know, nothing happened under Bernini, and then later the idea was brought up again by Carlo Fontana. You see here a project for the new design of the Borgo in 1694 and Cosimo Morelli in 1776. So we can, I think, assume that the idea was somewhat in the air, right? In the early years of the 20th century, that it might have been talked about. Cass Gilbert went to Rome all the time and probably might have heard of these ideas. And one of the purposes was, of course, to create a vista, but also to make processions a little easier to the cathedral. And so Alexander VI already had sort of dreamed of a straight street, as you can see here. So this is nevertheless, I think, a very important proposal because, of course, Cass Gilbert spoke with the voice of a sort of foreign authority, if you like, and one shouldn't underestimate his influence. In fact, in August 1926, the architect Glenn Brown reports in the architectural record about Cass Gilbert and his proposal to build the connecting street instead of the skyscraper. And I quote, he says in this article in architectural record, nothing was heard from the letter for some time. The letter that Cass Gilbert had sent to Mussolini. Recently, a distinguished Italian who was visiting this country informed a friend of the fine arts that Mussolini, in directing the development of the city improvements, gave the officials a letter from a New York architect with instructions to follow its suggestions. If the suggestions of Gilbert have prevented the skyscraper in Rome and will open a view from the Bridge of St. Angelo to St. Peter's, he will have performed an international service to art, a service worthy of his new dignity as president of the National Academy of Design. Of course, when you read something like this, you know, one wonders, you know, did Cass Gilbert maybe, you know, maneuver this piece of information into the architectural record? We don't know, you know. And I also wondered, you know, when I saw this in a little article in the New York Times in the front cover, I tried to find out any other sort of reference to this. And I had the date, of course, and I had, you know, I knew when this exhibition opened, and so went through the the journal that basically published every single day Mussolini's work and his visits and what he did all day long. And I could never find a reference to this. So there's also a certain suspicion that maybe Palanti himself had sent this note to the New York Times and caused all this stir. But, you know, who knows? We'll hopefully I'll find out. So clearly, the relationship between Gilbert and Mussolini is an interesting point here. And so the suggestion that Gilbert had made in writing to Mussolini is something that I want to follow up a little bit further. And on Cass Gilbert's next visit to Rome, Mussolini agreed to meet him. And it's all in Cass Gilbert's diaries and his letters. It's really quite wonderful to research, but also scary because you obviously hear how this man fell for Mussolini and his fascist ideas. And something that always sort of shocks me when I read it. Cass Gilbert writes that he had this appointment and he waited outside and then was let into the audience room. And when the Duce entered the room and performed the fascist greeting, he says he remembers in a rush of emotion and somewhat involuntarily, he also raised his right arm. So there you see Cass Gilbert standing there and Mussolini meeting, and they both greet each other with a fascist greeting. It's really sort of shocking image, if you want. And so he's in Rome, and he meets, and we know from his diary what happened afterwards. So they greet each other. The audience was very short. Mussolini had the habit of having extremely short audiences, many, 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 throughout the day, with pretty much anybody who wanted to see him. And so in his diaries, he talks about this, and then Gilbert apparently shows the Duce some of his drawings and his work, and Mussolini tells him, "I would love to live in a skyscraper." And that, of course, would have been the clue for Gilbert to say, "So what do you think about that skyscraper that you published, and I wrote you this letter, do you remember?" And he actually had a copy of his letter in his pocket, but he was too shy to pull it out at that moment, and so he gives it to the translator after the audience to remind Mussolini that he had this letter and that he had written it to him. And Lillian Gibson, who gave English lessons to the Duce, promised to give it to him later. So it's hard to tell how much influence Gilbert had, how much influence his letter had, but of course the reasons that in the end led to the building of the Via della Conciliazione were rather complex. We cannot rule out that there is a certain amount of influence from Cass Gilbert, of course, but as you all know, probably the political constellations were complicated, and part of Mussolini's mission, of course, was to work with Pope Pius XI and sign the Lateran treaties, which for the first time really regulated the relationship between the Italian state and the Vatican. It also meant that the Vatican recognized the Italian government and promised a certain degree of cooperation. And Catholicism became the official religion of Italy, and the Italian government in turn paid a lot of money to the Vatican and took over a number of technicalities, and for instance, all the sewage and drainage of the Vatican was sort of taken care of through the city of Rome. And so finally the decision is made after the Lateran Treaty had been signed to indeed now take down the Borgo Nuovo and build this street. It was a complex undertaking that took several years to work out, and then in 1929 the contract is signed, and then there's a signed, and then a commission had to be put together, the Commissione Tecnica Italo-Vaticana, that needed another 4 years to work out all the details. They had to demolish, of course, some buildings that were owned by the Vatican, and finally design by Marcello Piacentini with Attilio Spaccarelli is then indeed realized. And you see here the street almost finished, and Mussolini with the two architects standing there. The street, in fact, is built in 1938. Taking down the process begins in 1938 and then is only finished in 1950 because the interruption of the war, obviously. So clearly, after the signing of those Lateran treaties, the street had gained a new importance because it had become the symbol of this connection between the city of Rome and the Vatican in it, and the relationship, of course, between the fascists and the Church, and many volumes have been written about, as you all know, about the role of Pius XI and his stance against the fascists and the Nazis in Germany, and perhaps, lack of support for Jews in Italy. And it's a very, very complicated chapter, as you can imagine. But what I wanted to talk about a little bit more is, of course, not only this street, which is one of many, but rather, in fact, the sort of development of town planning ideas in those years that we are looking at. This is finally the street as it was built by Piacentini and Spaccarelli, as you can see here, and clearly now links those urban focal points. But before already, Mussolini in those years, this is 25, so we're just talking about the moment when our hero, or not hero really, but the focus here, Mr. Pallanti, has returned to Buenos Aires, has already introduced the skyscraper. He's back now reworking it. And in the meantime, Mussolini in a way lays out in a letter to the sort of mayor of Rome his ideas for town planning. And these are clearly based, as one can see here, on the idea of opening up parts of the city so that important buildings are isolated, the creation of vistas. For instance, he talks about a new axis that he wants to have built from Piazza Colonna to make the Pantheon visible, so there would be a cut right through here, and I think ideally to allow Mussolini to view down from his office the front of the Pantheon. And he talks about the 1,000-year-old monuments of our history should impress us from their isolated position. So this is the new approach, a reach back to the Roman history and in a way to isolating its monuments. And in a way, this is rather sort of typical for those years in the middle of the 1920s where Mussolini begins to, in a way, formulate more ideas for urban planning. Marcello Piacentini develops a plan for the Great Rome, Grande Roma, as you can see here, and proposes an axis roughly on this area where the railroad station is now, and suggests to move that railroad station further back, as you can see here on the left, build a monumental building, but also create a deep axis with viewpoints and clearly a sort of visual connection between individual monuments. And Piacentini, of course, then rises into this prominent position under Mussolini with a style that is both, you know, making gestures towards modern architecture, but also in his early designs, as you can see here, famously, the Albergo degli Ambasciatori, still very much involved in this sort of rather unique form of Italian use of classical and Renaissance forms. So finally, 1926, Pallanti returns to Rome, and he has worked very hard on the design of the tower, and he writes to Mussolini, who again allows him to have an exhibition right there in the Palazzo Chigi, in the Salone della Vittoria, just in the place where Mussolini had his office. And Pallanti publishes a little book, which I was happy to buy on eBay at some point. And it's about this design, and there are a number of short essays in it and supporting letters from prominent politicians, architects, Manfredo Manfredi, and the royal family supports him in his endeavor of building this skyscraper. The Prince of Savoy writes a little a note saying this tower that Pallanti is planning would be very, very sort of graceful in Rome and would add to the fame of Rome and the new epoch. And so Pallanti returns, obviously, and has now a theory that he developed, and he points out that this tower should be, in a way, a sort of symbolic fulfillment of the triad of buildings that are already there, namely St. Peter's and Catholicism and Vittorio Emanuele Monument, the altar of the fatherland, and then his tower for the fascist revolution in this position there. So he feels it's really the concluding monument for the heart of Rome. And he designs a slightly different version, as you can see here, with a somewhat smaller footprint, a little shorter, as you can see here. And I have a feeling that this design, quite differently drawn, quite beautiful, this is now 1926, and that he was inspired probably by things that in the meantime had appeared in America, namely Hugh Ferris's drawings for A Metropolis of Tomorrow. You see the way the shadow is handled, and so a little setback. It's all together a more dynamic design, really. And so he publishes this and holds this exhibition, and Mussolini, apparently, according to Palanti, came to the opening of the exhibition and said that this design was, and I quote, "e veramente impressionante e formidabile." So Mussolini was obviously, you know, always happy to give great compliments to the many admirers that he would see. And Palanti did everything that he could to keep the sympathies of the Duce and to build the project. He gave another stipend for architecture students. He actually offered to give a horse to the Duce. All of this is in the archive in EUR, including he became a member of the Fascist Party in Milan, of course. And this horse is a rather wonderful story. I'm sitting there in Rome in the archive, and I look through the correspondence, and there's a little photo of the horse that he wanted to give to the Duce, a very nice horse. And then there is behind is a letter from the embassy in Buenos Aires saying the Duce should not accept the present of this horse because apparently it belongs to Palanti's wife, from whom he is estranged, and he actually was on board the ship traveling to Rome with a young woman that apparently was not his wife. And you know, you learn more about Palanti than you actually might have wanted to. So that's so Mussolini doesn't take the horse, but he clearly tries to win this commission despite, of course, the international reactions in the press. So he, in fact, decides to make sure that the sort of furor in the international press that had came, that he was protected against this. And he designed a number of versions. So this is the first version. And then he designed a second version that you just saw, which is a little shorter, 330 meters to now down 10% to 300 meters tall. And then he designed in this little booklet another version, much shorter, so that, you know, the critics who felt he was spoiling the cityscape of Rome would be appeased, and then finally a last version, much smaller, just in case, you know, there was a chance to build it. So clearly he's trying everything he can to build this, but nothing happens. He even has an audience with the Pope here for his 44-story version, as the Washington Post reports dutifully and describes about Palanti's designs. So in the meantime, Marcello Piacentini begins, or it's more and more engaged in urban planning in Rome, and in fact the governor of the city of Rome, Filippo Cremonesi, is very much involved with Piacentini in new planning proposals, the opening of the zone of antiquity, the old heart of Rome and antiquities, all the way up to the Colosseum and the building of the Via Imperiale and the Via Mara, following, of course, the old design of the Piazza del Popolo in a very similar angle and reaching out quite symbolically to Ostia and to the mountains. And work gets underway to, in fact, open the archaeological remains and isolating those individual monuments, just as Mussolini had stated in his statement. One could probably say that all of this might be part of the reaction to Cass Gilbert's proposal, who had said something very similar of what he felt was the best recipe for Rome. A few years later, in fact, so this skyscraper obviously is not built, and Palanti feels rather disappointed and still takes part in a competition in 1934, many years later, where a palace to the fascist revolution is supposed to be built in 1934 along this new axis, very close to the Vittorio Emanuele, and it's called Palazzo del Littorio. So it takes that same name that his skyscraper had originally carried. And now this competition is held, and there's a lot of interesting work also by modern architects such as Terragni and Lingheri, and here is Libera. All of these are, of course, rather interesting modernist approaches and responses to the capital. And here, you know, rather interesting in Cambridge, you know, a predecessor for a building that many of you are familiar with at MIT, and very, very interesting designs. Nothing is built, but of course, Palanti takes part in this competition. Marcello Piacentini is, in fact, the man who supervises this competition, And he had set height limits. I had a feeling he knew Palanti would come out of the woodwork again with another skyscraper. So he had set height limits for all the contributions. But Palanti didn't follow those and designs this rather strange-looking ship of the fascist state with this enormous tower there at the end, as you can see here. And he was disqualified. And one of the critics, Giuseppe Pagano, wrote in his critique, the only thing he said about Mario Palanti's design was that it was that it showed South American and shark-like snobbery, whatever that means, shark-like snobbery. I like that very much. And Palanti was very, very angry and wrote a letter to the Duce complaining about Piacentini, the great now prominent architect, organizer of this competition, in a way the key figure in Italian architecture at that moment. And he writes in this letter, which is also in the archive and EUR, "While I was crossing the oceans in 1924 and 1926 and presented to the Duce a grandiose project that he gave the dedication Per la mole littoria alla la, Piacentini, who wasn't even a real fascist, obstructs the way for those who have a sacred right to it." Desperation, of course, in the meantime. This is also not built, and the development takes its course. Palanti survives the war, never builds anything again, but never gives up his ambition to grandeur, publishes books with his designs in the 40s and 50s. He obviously has a little money, and he designs even a brick that he calls Palandomos, and he dreams, you see it here on the right, he dreams that that brick would conquer the world, as you can see here in the cover drawing. But before I end, I wanted to have a very brief epilogue, or rather three very brief epilogues, because the story has sort of strange repercussions elsewhere. When the American troops reached Berlin at the end of the war, 1945, they found Hitler's library in the Staatskanzlei, and they took the books and brought them to the Library of Congress in New York, where they still are. And among those books was this little blue book by Palanti, and it had a dedication by Palanti, and it says here, "To the distinguished Dottore Adolfo Hitler with revering admiration." So he had obviously sent a copy of his book to Hitler, hoping, I guess, that Hitler would maybe designed this tower, built the tower in the heart of Berlin or whatever, you know. So he sent this book dedicated to Hitler, but Hitler was not really interested. The tallest tower that was sort of designed under his the fascist government in Germany, the National Socialist government, was this tower for Hamburg. But Hitler just didn't like the idea altogether, and quite the contrary. In fact, he forbid all skyscrapers in Germany in 1934. There are a few high-rises that Albert Speer designed in rather comparatively modest scale, and with very little resemblance to Palanti's vision. So I would doubt that Palanti sent his book to Stalin as well, because he was obviously a fascist and Stalin was a communist. But something interesting happened, because if you look at designs that are happening in Moscow in the early 30s, there is, of course, the Palace of the Soviets by Boris Yofan, which has a very similar structure in a way. Also, you know, parliamentary halls and a mix of uses, hotel, etc., etc. The same sort of completely missing sense of scale, as you all know, and a very similar function. And it turns out that Boris Yofan, the architect, had actually studied and lived in Rome at exactly that moment when Palanti had these two exhibitions, so he knew about them. And he saw that probably, in all likelihood, he saw those two exhibitions, so when he was offered this job of designing a palace of the Soviets, he, in fact, might have remembered this. And it had a very similar spatial program, obviously. And as many of you know, there were a sort of number of versions also getting smaller and smaller, as you can see here on the left, grandiose interiors. The echo of this, of course, lives on in the Lomonosov University and others. They actually started building it, as many of you know. They took down the cathedral of the Savior in downtown Moscow and dug the hole for the foundations, and then the war came, and this enormous hole in the ground right in the heart of Moscow became the largest swimming pool in Moscow for many years, until a few years ago the Cathedral of the Savior was rebuilt. And then the third part of the epilogue is that one day a friend of mine sent me a little note per email and said, "Have you heard of this book? There's a book out that describes, it's a novel fictitious novel that describes how Mussolini had a skyscraper built with the help of a lot of Jewish workers and architects who are saved in the process because they work on this enormous tower for Mussolini. And so Ezra Pound is mentioned, very intricate story. I said, no, I haven't heard of the book, but of course I ordered it right away. It's called The Eighth Wonder of the World by Leslie Epstein. And it came out about 2 or 3 years ago. You seem to know it. And so I wrote to Leslie Epstein, who is here in Boston and lives here in Boston and a writer. And he wrote back and said...
He teaches at BU.
He teaches here at BU, exactly. And he's not here, right, is he?
No.
No, because, no actually, I told him I was going to talk about it, and he seems really nice. He wrote back and said, you know, I can't believe it. I did so much research for my book on Mussolini's skyscraper, but I made it all up, and I never came across this skyscraper, so I sent him all the photos and whatever I had, and here's his email. I loved it. You know, if only I'd known. I never did come across the material you mentioned, et cetera, et cetera, so certainly would have used it. So, and then he talks about how he began this novel thinking about the Italian army and of course, felt that, you know, his interest in Ezra Pound and Rome and architecture, Frank Lloyd Wright, all came together. He added a touch of Bucky Fuller and then dreamed the whole thing up. And that, of course, made me very happy, you know, sort of art imitating life without knowing it, as you can see here. And so to conclude, obviously, historians have until now somewhat mercifully, I must say, overlooked this entire incident and its somewhat unconventional connection to Rome's urban history. And, of course, the development of skyscrapers in Europe at that point. And I think all of this suggests perhaps reasons for a resurrection of historical research into this project. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Brown University professor Dietrich Neumann titled A Skyscraper for Mussolini, Mario Polanti and Urban Planning for Rome in the 1920s. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Graduate Student Art History Association in the Department of Art History at Boston University. Our speaker was introduced by graduate student Hannah Blunt. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.